Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Major General Mike Myatt, President and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association, and your chair for this evening. Tonight's program is co-sponsored by the Marines Memorial Association, a nonprofit veterans organization. The Marines Memorial is chartered to honor the memory of the United States veterans of the armed forces who are lost in the service to our country. We also welcome our listeners on radio, and we invite everyone to visit the Commonwealth Club on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org and the Marines Memorial at www.marineclub.com. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening, Major General Tony Taguba. Recently retired from the United States Army, General Taguba served as the principal U.S. military investigator into the events at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq in 2004. I'm honored to be able to introduce General Taguba because I know him very well. Some 15 years ago, I was looking for a person to serve as my executive assistant in a very sensitive position in the Republic of Korea. I needed someone who had impeccable operational credentials, who was known to be completely candid when asked to state his opinion, and whose integrity was of the highest order. I found the right man in Tony Taguba. He was then a lieutenant colonel who had just given up command after two very successful years as the commanding officer of an armored battalion in the 2nd Infantry Division. Tony and I served together for 2 years, and we became very good friends. I followed Tony's career after that to watch him go to top-level school to command a brigade, an armored brigade, and then his selection for general officer. He comes from an Army family. His father served as a Filipino scout in World War II, where he was captured by the Japanese on the Bataan Peninsula and put on the Bataan Death March, which he later escaped. General Taguba is married to a wonderful woman, Debbie Taguba, and they have two marvelous children, both of whom are college graduates, embarked on promising careers. His son, Sean, was recently commissioned as a second lieutenant in the United States Army in armor, following in his father's footsteps. Please join me in welcoming Major General Tony Taguba.
Let me get situated here for a second. Can everybody see me? All right, good. I used to be 6'2 and 220 pounds, but this past 3 years have been rather rough on me. So when they kind of shave you and by people that I don't even know were shaving me at any time. Thank you very much, General Myatt, for that generous introduction. I want to add that I have great admiration for General Myatt, my former boss and a great friend. He's also a very wonderful mentor who made me read books, and then we reviewed about it. And that's a telling sign of a great leader in trying to teach his subordinate about this thing called the military profession. Of course, he once tried to make a Marine out of me. And on one occasion, we've been working really hard. He told me that I needed some time off. Instead, he sent me off to Okinawa to spend a week training with a Marine outfit. That was his blend of humor, you might say. I did have a terrific time then, but I preferred to stay in the Army. But in any case, it's nice to have someone pronounce my last name correctly. While I was testifying before Congress in May of 2004, my sister-in-law counted the 17 different ways that my last name was mispronounced by some members of Congress, and I watched one congressman cover his mouth because he could not somehow pronounce my the six letters that made up my last name. I try to maintain my composure because I would have really laughed my head off. But good evening, everyone. Good to see you. I want to thank Dr. Gloria Duffy. Ma'am, where are you? I think you might be here us somewhere. To Mr. George Dobbins, to Mr. Gordon Feller for inviting me to the Commonwealth Club and speak on a topic that has generated a great amount of interest. It is truly an honor for me to be with you this evening. George Dobbins told me that this is another sold-out event, so I hope I'm contributing to his financial stability of some sort. But next time when you make more money, George, you know, you may want to pass out the popcorn and some other drinks, maybe a glass of wine for all of our guests. I brought along a few reinforcements with me, my cousins who are longtime residents of the San Francisco area, Miss Conchita Sibaluca, who's seated here in the front. Her daughter, Virginia, and her husband, Larry Scanlon. And their daughter, Michelle. Incidentally, Conchita's husband, Army Sergeant First Class, retired. Victor Sibaluca was captured in Bataan also on 9 April 1942, along with my father. But he didn't have the luxury of escaping, and he spent over a year as a prisoner of war. He passed away in 1998. I also brought along a friend, and I hope you're out there, Mr. Eric Nishizawa. You raise your hand. I guess he hasn't made it out yet. Where are you? Hey, Eric. Esquire from Los Angeles, just in case I need legal counsel during my presentation. Especially after last week's article in the New Yorker magazine. And speaking of the Hirsch article, I thought of calling Mr. Dobbins and canceling out to San Francisco. I figured I'd just send him a copy of the magazine and pass it out to you. But then I would not have an excuse to get away from the Washington, D.C. area for a couple of days just to spend some time with my dear relatives here. Of course, for those of you who've been inside the Beltway, life inside that pit, you might say, can be depressing and frustrating, given the political debates on such trivial topics like Iraq, immigration, stem cell research, the crisis in the Justice Department, the continuing saga there, and the pronouncements from the candidates who aspire to be the next president of this country. Of course, the fresh air and the wine here in San Francisco, in California, is much more refreshing. And I know my dear wife, Debbie, is probably saying all kinds of not so good words about me being out here. But to be serious, though, I want to preface that my remarks and my perceptions and my thoughts that I want to share with you are my own personal views and not endorsed by anyone or by any organization. So before I cover how deeply Abu Ghraib has affected our nation, please permit me to set the stage just a bit for my presentation. The unconscionable acts committed by several of our soldiers were indeed preventable, given the discipline and training of our military, especially during a time of war, if only these soldiers were properly led and supervised. The ambiguous chain of command and questionable set of policies that we uncovered were, of course, were the contributing factors along with the tremendous demands placed upon the limited number of military police and military intelligence forces to gather intelligence from the growing number of detainees. These, of course, these factors would eventually resulted in the environment revealed at Abu Ghraib. It took a junior enlisted soldier, Specialist Joseph Darby, who possessed the moral courage to report the criminal acts at Abu Ghraib. He toiled with his moral conscience for 2 days before he decided to turn in the evidence that we know. Yet he too was ostracized and placed on witness protection that he is today. I believe you saw, some of you have seen him on 60 Minutes yesterday, last night. Of course, Darby was just doing his duty. I'm sure that most of you have watched with great interest the congressional hearings in May and September of 2004. The CD containing the images of abuse, torture, and sexual acts were shown to members of Congress. A few members remarked that Abu Ghraib was just a consequence of war. Or was it just that? You have to ask yourself that question. I don't think these distinguished members of Congress fully understood what their dismissive comments really meant. I don't even think that they would remember the gruesome beheading of Nick Berg, videoed by al-Zarqawi's group that followed the revelations of Abu Ghraib, or the burning and decapitation of four American civilian contract security personnel, or how the images of inhumane treatment of detainees by U.S. troops shown on the Arab news networks fueled the region's animosity against us, and that their views today of America have increasingly been negative since then. We say that the wonders of information technology called the Internet demonstrated how effective those networks in the region have utilized it to incite Arab sentiments against our country today. Now, the images of Abu Ghraib place our troops in greater risk than we can ever have imagined, and that was our first and foremost concern when we conducted the investigation, at least my team did, and that we worried about how it was going to be received once it was exposed. We did not plan for the report to be leaked. Of course, I did not leak it, and I still don't know who did. The results of the unintended consequences of what we call a war. We have gone from a war that toppled Saddam Hussein to an insurgency and now a civil war. Our troops have yet to come home for a ticker tape parade today. Now, the program said I was going to cover some bits and pieces about the elements of our national power of diplomacy, information, military, and economics, which we in the military are taught incessantly over the course of our years as a senior leader. These four elements of our national power have greatly affected our country after the aftermath of Abu Ghraib. Now, the effects in itself are difficult to measure. The euphoria of a military victory ended in May of 2004. The public support has declined or it continues to decline. And yet we don't have a coherent exit strategy as of today. The U.S. foreign policy in the region is dubious at best. The diplomatic efforts of our government have shown signs of desperation. The policy of advancing democracy in the region has resulted in a divided Palestinian government. Currently, the situation in Palestine has shifted U.S. support to Abbas and the Fatah group against Hamas today. When I had completed my investigation, I was still assigned in the region with a headquarters in Kuwait. And one of my duties was to travel to different countries because we had troops in those countries. And every occasion, before I could conduct any type of military visits or that sort of nature of my duties, I had to report to the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador. And needless to say, there was such a big clamor about the results of Abu Ghraib that he wanted to know how I could help them at least ameliorate their concerns. And needless to say, I must tell you, that was very tough. It was yet to be corrected today. Saudi Arabia has grown weary of its support of the U.S. policy in the region. In fact, when I landed at one of the military airports there, because we had 200 troops guarding an organization, American organization, they wanted to know the nature of my business. They were fearful that I was there to investigate their detention operations or their prisons. And it took time for them to clear my visa. Of course, now the Iraq study group's recommendations are now being dusted off, finally, especially the ISG's recommendation to open diplomatic dialogues with Iran and Syria. Now, history, all of you are students of history, has reminded us that France, Great Britain, and even Germany and Russia have attempted to advance their own policies in the region, but to no avail. that we should try to learn from their own experiences and try not to repeat them. The State Department's efforts in public diplomacy and public affairs is gaining some traction in promoting the positive vision of democracy to enable U.S. policy, foreign policy. They have been successful, though, on the education portion of their program, especially when we have student exchange programs. However, organizations such as the Human Rights Watch and the growing disenchantment of Americans against the war seem to counter their efforts. On the economic side of the house, that portion of our national power appeared to be in flux. And inside the military, defense spending is only about 4%, 4% of the gross domestic product. We are now going to be reaching almost $400 billion in funding the war, and the Army and Marines are requesting approval from the President and Congress to add thousands more to grow its ranks for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There will be more funds requested to rebuild and modernize the military services if and when the war ends. With the current uproar regarding the military's health care program and the veterans' benefits, with the growing number of wounded that are coming back from the war, our country must provide the resources to support our troops. And these will cost billions of dollars more, and I sincerely believe, that our troops and their families deserve it. As for the military, I cannot underscore the monumental demands placed on them and their loved ones. The ground troops are going through their third or fourth tours in combat today. The Army, of course, go there for 12 months. It used to be, now it's up to 15 months. Our Marines are 7 months. However, they go on repetitive rotations to encompass roughly about 14 months or longer. Over 30 great Americans have been killed in action just this past 2 weeks. The loss of limbs, traumatic brain injuries, and post-traumatic stress syndrome reside in those who are wounded, numbering over 30,000 today. The families of our troops are experiencing the high stress of having their loved ones continually deployed in harm's way, and they are heroes in my book. I call them the 51% of the vote, and sometimes the 51% of the vote puts in that ticker and says, we have to do something different. America's military represent less than 1%, roughly 2.3 million of America's population. Yet the president declared that our nation is at war against terrorism. And you get to wonder, where is the rest of them? Let me now shift on the lessons learned of Abu Ghraib and cover three major points. America prides itself in having the most powerful military force today, best led, best trained, best equipped, but not perfect. Once the abuses of Abu Ghraib were reported, the Army wasted no time. The Army wasted no time. And we did things in parallel while I was conducting an investigation then, in taking immediate and deliberate corrective actions. New procedures on detaining operations that include the medical and psychological side, to include interrogation procedures, were quickly implemented and closely supervised. Field training and detention handling were revised or improved at home station training, and soldiers were certified in these training techniques prior to their deployment. Just recently, a new human intelligence collection operations field manual was published to ensure military interrogators adhere to legally authorized tactics and techniques governed by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The law of land warfare and Geneva Convention were strictly emphasized. There were several high-level military investigations that ensued to determine exactly what the levels of command responsibility rested. Thus far, only a few soldiers, to include a brigadier general and a colonel, have been punished or imprisoned. However, the Army was not about to hide the fact that something terrible, something despicable had happened at a major prison site in Iraq. It was their core duty to correct it. And we evolve on those corrections to ensure that we are improving the training that we are providing our troops today. The second point is that Abu Ghraib further exacerbated the heated debates on the administration's policy of cruel treatment of unlawful enemy combatants, which originally began in 2002 regarding detention operations at Guantanamo. Mr. Alberto Mora, the former general counsel of the Navy, led the charge along with the military services judge advocates general at the height of Abu Ghraib in disputing the opinions of the Justice Department in adopting a policy of cruel treatment, which is in contravention of established laws and especially the Geneva Convention. The government made policy decisions that detainees as unlawful enemy combatants could be subjected to interrogation techniques constituting inhumane treatment. The premise of Mr. Morris's legal views and supported by the military's judge advocates general on this policy was the clear violation of the Geneva Convention, which could place our military troops in jeopardy under the Uniform Court of Military Justice while protecting other government agencies, namely the CIA, from prosecution. In the end, the Detainee Act of 2005 and the Military Commission Act of 2006 resulted from these debates. Now, recently, the military court proceedings against two detainees have demonstrated the inadequacies of the Military Commission Act when the presiding military justice challenged the government's case against these two detainees. The key point of contention here was whether the government had proven the two detainees in question as unlawful enemy combatants. The government is appealing that case. This recent turn of events demonstrated what appears to be flaws in the military tribunal system to prosecute detainees under the Military Commission Act. In its haste to enact new laws against enemy combatants, the Justice Department through Congress failed to notice this key discrepancy. I am sure that there will be more legal contentions to follow. Although the President has publicly stated that we do not torture prisoners, there still remain in question the policy of cruel treatment that continue to linger. There seems to be a tacit acceptance in our country, most notably in the executive branch of our government, that cruel treatment of enemy prisoners is allowable. I command that we cannot abdicate our responsibility to comply with the Geneva Convention only because those who are doing the fighting to preserve our freedom, America's men and women in uniform, are expected to conform with the rule of law. There is little understanding from the highest level of civilian authorities of the disastrous consequences if we continue on this path. You must think of the four soldiers today that are being held as prisoners of war or as missing in action. Think of the over 3,500 men and women who have given their lives upholding the rule of law, and to the thousands of casualties who are the faces of the loyal and dedicated service to this nation. Lastly, after 3 years of numerous congressional hearings, with over a dozen high-level investigations, countless books and articles written, two documentaries produced, several laws that have been passed, and several soldiers punished or imprisoned, there is still the unanswered question of whether high-level military and civilian authorities should be held accountable. In the Navy, when the captain of a ship that runs aground or collides with another ship while a subordinate is in charge in the bridge, he is held accountable and can be relieved of command or court-martialed. This scenario, while true, may be an exaggeration when applied to our high-level government officials, but Abu Ghraib was not an exaggeration, nor was it just a bunch of rogue soldiers who acted independently in committing hideous criminal acts in time of war. I suspected that they were influenced or were instructed by senior officials who were acting from higher authority on written or verbal guidance, most likely classified. In my report, my team and I could not find evidence of any such policy, and subsequent investigations ruled out the culpability of senior officials in the Pentagon and also the White House. If you believe that no one else at those levels were responsible, then you must discount that the CIA is not operating secret interrogation sites at overseas locations. What is about integrity and honesty that even senior leaders in the highest level of our government fear most when confronted with a devastating circumstance like Abu Ghraib? For those like Darby and most recently the interrogators who came forward to talk about torture and abuse, it is almost a contradiction to think that integrity and truth can become a crime. Darby and few others found their moral compass. I wonder if those in positions of power, past and present, will find theirs and account for their actions or inactions. Now, I believe the damage done to America by the revelations of Abu Ghraib is indeed repairable, but not in the near distant future. In the meantime, this does not prevent us as citizens from making amends to the rest of the world. It is what morally and ethically decent people would expect from a country who tries to advance democracy in a troubled world under the threat of global terrorism and their brutal followers. We cannot allow something like Abu Ghraib to be just a topic of polite conversation or file it away so it can be forgotten. A lot of people paid for their lives as a consequence of this horrible event. As a consolation, the prison at Abu Ghraib was turned over to Iraqi control in September of 2006. We still maintain detention operations at Camp Cropper and Camp Buka in Iraq, and not to mention the one in a place called Guantanamo. Our troops in combat are the faces in a war against a brutal enemy in Iraq and Afghanistan. Whatever they do, whether conducting close combat operations or nation building or humanitarian assistance, all have strategic significance. Their conduct can either be praised or condemned by the world as they have experienced and what we have seen. Today, the level of training our troops are receiving extends from the tactical to their strategic levels. Sergeants, lieutenants, up to generals are interacting with the local populace and civic leaders in provinces and towns as a medium to gain the people's trust and confidence in fighting the insurgency. They are not trained to be diplomats nor schooled in politics, but they are certainly the only ones available to be at the point of the spear. It's also refreshing to know that Abu Ghraib has become a subject of intellectual discussions and education as case studies at several of our military and civilian institutions of higher learning today and at leadership seminars. If nothing else, America's future leaders can learn from the lessons learned of this horrible event. I want to close by sharing with you a personal value of mine. I reminded myself that should I still be in a position of influence, even while facing adversity, I will do my utmost to preserve the faith of our citizens in our military institutions, especially those in harm's way. I will help to seek some form of redemption in restoring the trust and confidence of our citizens. I say that because I owe a great deal, a lot of great deal, to the wonderful soldiers and families whom I will never forget. And who worked, excuse me. Lost my sight here. And who work hard to place me in this position of trust. I rehearsed this, by the way. It's not coming out very well. I came without knowing that I shared some responsibility on Abu Ghraib. Only because the soldiers involved, directly or indirectly, belonged to the magnificent army I served under. It is about living up to our core values. So, I know you're getting anxious and asking questions of me, most likely about the article in the New Yorker magazine. I didn't bring any extra copies with me, by the way. Mr. Hirsch was rather chintzy about it. I hope he doesn't hear this. So I appreciate your very much for the invitation to join you this evening. And excuse me for my, if I could ask you for your indulgence for my pause a minute. God bless our troops in harm's way. Please pray for them and their loved ones that they have left behind. God bless America. Thank you. Please sit down.
Our thanks to Antonio Taguba, retired U.S. Army Major General who served as the principal U.S. military investigator into the events at Abu Ghraib prison. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be moderating today's question audience period. And General Taguba, we do have many, many questions for you.
God. All right. Is it $5 per question? Is that what we're doing?
Well, I'll combine some of those so we can save the Commonwealth
Club some money.
And we'll
split it? Okay.
I agonized a little bit before tonight's program on this first question. It's a long one, but what I want to do with this is I want to set the stage for what I think is one of the key issues here, and it has to do with leadership or lack of leadership, and has to do with the chain of command that we have in this country. On November 13th, 2001, the Vice President Cheney produced, and when I say produced, I mean he created, along with his general counsel, a military order which was then signed by President Bush. And this stated that, and I quote, foreign terrorism suspects held by the United States were stripped of access to any court, civilian or military, domestic or foreign. They could be confined indefinitely without charge and would be tried, if at all, in closed military commissions. Then Secretary of State Colin Powell said upon finding out about this order, said, and I quote, what the hell happened? Then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice was reported to be incensed. And this is from reporter Bart Gellman's series, which many of you might have seen, which started yesterday in the Washington Post. It's a series on the vice president. And according to the vice president's general counsel, again, the vice president is neither part of the executive branch, nor is he part of the legislative branch. So the point I'm making here, sorry for this long introduction, but the point here is that this vice president might be answerable to no one. General Taguba, please tell us what you know and feel about how much Dick Cheney was involved with the knowledge of torture and violations of Geneva Conventions at Abu Ghraib prison.
I told him I was going to do the Karnak impression. I'm in pain right now. I can't comment on the second portion of it about whether he is a member of the elected side of our government or the legislative side of the government. But I just want to comment that way back when in November of 2001, we were in a vengeful mode. We wanted to get even, for lack of a better term, for 9/11. And I was at the Pentagon when that happened, when that airplane hit the side of the Pentagon. And I had just left that the one and only three-star general, a close friend of mine, who was killed that day. And I was close enough that that it threw me on the ground and not knowing that what was happening. And about 5 minutes before that, I was with Lieutenant General Tim Maud is his name, whose wife had worked for me, watching the airplanes hit the Twin Towers. At that moment, about 9:30, 9:35, when that airplane hit, I was about a distance of about 100 feet away from his office and could not fathom what the heck was going on. I thought a generator underneath the basement of the Pentagon had blown up. So we were in that fury that something has to be done, regardless what. But over time, you get to collect your senses, and you say that we cannot succumb to the level that they are operating under, that this is about America, that we're going to send troops later on. And you can't send troops that have been trained, are disciplined, regimented to follow the rule of law and go out there and be like them. There's just no way. We will not have that brand of revenge on our hands. And that was then. And I would submit to you that we've gone over time in trying to change that. And if you listen to Secretary Powell during his interview with Tim Russert, we hold that. We have core values that has been inculcated on us for the longest of time. This is a country of about 232 years now. Our Marines and our Army have been older than that. And we subscribe to the core values that we hold so true today. And we have to honor those troops to follow that rule of law. We have to. Otherwise, we lose the honor and prestige of our military institutions.
General Taguba, would you say that you did have any success or bring forth any knowledge in your report that the abuses going on at Abu Ghraib were known and maybe encouraged by, say, Secretary Rumsfeld and the Vice President?
Yes and no. As I mentioned in my investigation, we could not find clear evidence that written policy or even verbal was done. But we suspected, since that our troops that committed these crimes, as I mentioned, were not that creative, barring any lack of training that they had or did not receive at home station. We also found out through our investigation that there were several people that were supervising them in the handling of our detainees. And the soldiers that we interviewed, as junior as they were mentioning names of those people that were supervising them. Some were military police leaders and some were military intelligence leaders. But the scope of my investigation was limited to the military police. But I could not just investigate the military police because the detention operations at Abu Ghraib constituted several elements. Military police, military intelligence, there was an engineer unit assigned there. There were doctors, there were chaplains, you name it. And at that point in time, the leadership changed from the military police of commanding or controlling that facility and shifted to the military intelligence during the time that discoveries of abuses were uncovered, allegations of abuses were uncovered. So with counsel from my legal, from the lawyers that was on my team, that we could interview a few, in fact, just about four or five of the military intelligence side. So we turned over that portion of it to a military intelligence investigation. But suffice to say, to answer the question, as I mentioned in my comment, I suspected that there is some degree of guidance that was promulgated from higher authority.
I recently heard the term Gitmoizing of Abu Ghraib. Were the intelligence gathering techniques, including torture and humiliation, part of a larger detainee prison policy?
I can't cover that much because I've never been to Guantanamo, and I've never visited Guantanamo, nor have I ever spoken in great detail with any members of the team that was operating at Guantanamo. That phrase came out of an interview with General Karpinski, now Colonel Karpinski, on her discussions with General Miller, I think it was. But I believe it was about utilizing the same operational techniques and systems that they had at Guantanamo and apply it to Abu Ghraib. Our contention was that the environment at Guantanamo was such that it was in a permissive area. They were not being mortared. They were not being shot at like they had at Abu Ghraib. And the squalid conditions at Abu Ghraib was not the same as that at Guantanamo.
Could you please tell us about, I think, Sergeant Joseph Darby? Was that his rank?
Right. Yeah, Specialist Joseph Darby was one of the time that we had known him. But
I understand that he actually was being interviewed last night, I think, by, was it on 60 Minutes?
60 Minutes.
Yeah. And so could you tell us what role he played and how significant this was in your discoveries for your report?
I have yet to meet Joseph Darby. I think he had an article also on Vanity Fair or Gentleman's Quarterly that I read. He's my hero. A young man, not necessarily a model soldier, but he is a soldier after all. And he was there serving his country. And the details of his revelations was such that he was asking for pictures of their assignment, him and the other MPs that were caught in the allegations. And he wanted pictures so he can send it home or take it home with him to share with his family. Little did he know that some of those pictures were downloaded on this CD. And he was reviewing the CD and he uncovered that there were some despicable acts. And he toiled with his conscience for 2 days, if I'm not mistaken. And he slipped the CD with a note underneath the door of a criminal investigator. Ben, he was fearful for his life. Of course, you know, you do something to turn in your fellow soldiers, though you were doing something that was morally conscionable, until somebody had mentioned his name on a TV while he was having lunch or dinner at a mess hall. And he was quickly whisked away, and he's still, I believe, on witness protection today. His hometown have not welcomed him home, so to speak, and pretty much ostracized him.
General Taguba, I have collected several questions on Brigadier General Janice Karpinski. She was a Commonwealth Club guest several years ago, February of 2005, I believe. And here's one. States that General Sanchez did appoint you to open, I guess, what's called Article 15-6, which is an inquiry into the conduct of the 800th Military Police Brigade. But I remember, according to General Karpinski, the abuse of prisoners actually started not by her brigade, because that was an MP or a military police brigade, but the abuse started, again, according to Janice Karpinski, when the military intelligence troops, which I think was known as the 364th, maybe, began their interrogation. 320th, pardon me. Do you agree with this question?
Well, let me make a correction. General Sanchez requested, through General Abizay's headquarters, the two-star general conduct an investigation of the 800 MP Brigade commanded then by General Karpinski. General Abizay's headquarters then directed my boss, Lieutenant General McKiernan, to appoint a two-star general, yours truly, to conduct the investigation. So just a matter of clarification. She assumed command of the 800 MP Brigade sometime in the latter part of June of 2003. And supposedly, or you might say factually, the allegations of abuse happened during her watch. I believe October, November, December time frame. There was a previous case of abuse at Camp Buka before she assumed command, but that was adjudicated. So I'm not sure what she is trying to detail to you, but in my estimation as a former military commander, that whatever your unit did, and when you assume command, that is then your responsibility to command that outfit, to properly lead it, to closely supervise it, and assume all responsibilities associated with that command. You do not deflect it to anybody else previous to you, nor deflect it to anybody else. You are the captain of that ship.
I do recall, because I participated in that program in 2005, that General Karpinski had heard that there were abuses going on and wanted to make some surprise visits in the evening to the Abu Ghraib prison. And she indicated that she was discouraged, strongly discouraged from doing that because of the danger that would be to her going there in the evening, making a surprise visit. Was that something that you recall in your investigation that she had stated?
She mentioned that, but you know, the occasion of these abuses were done during the period of about 10 o'clock in the evening to around 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's the best time to go visit your troops. Because, you know, as the old saying goes, when the cat is away, the rats are at play. And it's not a matter of hearing that abuses were being conducted. There were International Red Cross reports that abuses were being conducted. So you take those reports at face value, and you don't need another investigation to make a determination that something may be not right. So perhaps you stay there for a while and your presence made known to your troops through their cease and desist of what the heck is going on in there, and you do make surprise visits. And perhaps you can catch people in the act. But I'm not sure that she was persuaded not to stay there when I was up there conducting that investigation. Sometimes you kind of wonder what goes on in the middle of the night, you know. Why? Because there were 8,000 detainees and about close to 1,000 military forces there. But they're more endangered from mortar attacks and incursions than she was. You know, we're soldiers, for crying out loud. You stay with your troops. Be there. Be in front. Be respected. Hey, you know, I've always mentioned to my son that never be a leader where your soldiers follow you out of sheer curiosity. You know, you have to be there. People just can't say, well, I wonder what he's going to do today. Is he going to eat with us? Is he going to serve with us? Is he going to get muddy with us? And I believe in that. I know General Myatt told me that one time or another.
I have a slightly broader question here. Did abuses at Abu Ghraib, once made public, help fuel the insurgency?
A situation happened sometime in April where, at the time of the major ground combat, that was April 2004, I arrived there around the latter part of June of 2003, at the tail end of that. And we were retrograding forces at that time. We were trying to determine the amount of forces so we could secure the country and try to stabilize it and that sort of thing. The advent of foreign regime elements. We'll call them FREs, and the Fedayeen was brewing up, as you can imagine, if you recall that. And things were proceeding right along. But it doesn't take, it's a no-brainer that something was happening at Abu Ghraib at that time. There were family visits, I believe it was either Tuesdays or Thursdays. There was a lot of criminals in that facility. There was a lot of detainees that were being processed through that facility, and there, some of them were visiting their family loved ones. But the wonders of internet and the Arab news network like Al Arabiya or Al Jazeera, they were noticing, and they brought up, I still have a clip from Al Jazeera, that something had happened inside that prison. An investigation was being conducted and allegations of abuse and whatever have you. Okay, so you fast forward it a little bit, and things are not going so well. That by the time April, the latter part of April, turned around, instead of retrograding our forces for the next set to come in, we were sending them back because this person named Muqtada al-Sadr decided to rise up against us. So if you connect the dots a little bit, what happened with Nick Berg, what happened with the four civilians, contractors there, what happened at Fallujah when Gerald Conway, I believe he was here also, if I'm not mistaken. If you connect all of that, you know, there was a series of actions that determined that something else horrible was about to happen. There's going to be an uprising of some sort. So we were sending troops up there. In fact, that company that was involved with the prison abuse at Abu Ghraib, the 372nd MP Company, they were down to their last leaders because we were taking out leaders who were involved in the allegations. And when they showed up in Kuwait as they were retrograding, we had to send them back up. And those great Americans, those who were not involved, they said, "Sir, we'll go back, give me more ammunition, give me bigger guns, and we'll do our duty." So not everybody was involved in the allegations. It was a small amount of people, but that, you know, significantly, and it was a strategic blunder. But those troops went back. You know, folks from the States were called back so they can unwrap the wrappings that goes around your helicopters because they're ready to be shipped back. That's the amount of bravery those troops did. And that's why it's so close to my heart that when they're called to duty, they're going to do it. And they went, and they battled, and there was such amount of combat at that time, April, May, June, July, and the rest is history.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our speaker is retired U.S. Army General Antonio Taguba, who oversaw the military investigation into the events at Abu Ghraib prison. And he is discussing the impact of those events with us tonight. General Taguba, could you describe the population at Abu Ghraib prison? Weren't most of the prisoners just common criminals and not high-value detainees, such as those that existed at Guantanamo?
When I conducted the investigation, there were four detention camps, and I believe six prisons in the Baghdad area. But all in total, there are between 14 to 16 sites total, from big to large. There was Camp Buka, which is near Umm Qasr, just across the border from Kuwait to Iraq. There was Abu Ghraib, of course. There was Camp Ashraf, north of Baghdad, the Camp Cropper, which is at the Baghdad International Airport. Camp Cropper was held 101 prisoners. There were the high-value detainees, you might say, because they contained political and military officers that served with Saddam Hussein. And during the time I was there, it was down to 100 because Abu Abbas, I believe was his name, the terrorist who under Achille Lauro incident when he threw that. The man in the wheelchair overboard. The conditions at Abu Ghraib was such, it was horrible. And Abu Ghraib is situated to a town called Abu Ghraib. The prison was built in the 1960s by the British. Believe me, when you see, I know you've not seen it, but you see it, it was built for one purpose. You go in there, and you're never, ever going to be coming out. It was that kind of a facility. You had walls, tiers of what we call the hard site, hardened prison. I did not see any types of comfort items inside their cells. There was no lighting in there. Those prisoners that I saw, the U.S. held prisoners on Tier 1A and 1B, were using the light in the middle of the tiers. There were common criminals on the other tiers, meaning tiers is like one, you might say, one cell after the other, one series of cells after the other. Yes, they were considered as common criminals. The one that were being processed after capture by U.S. forces were being processed, being signed in, being documented, and then they get through a filtering system. There were two other camps outside the facility, and they filtered them through to enable the interrogators to make a determination which one should be high-valued and which one should be interrogated and which one should be held indefinitely. Conditions could have been improved. There was a landfill that I saw. The troops were living in squalid conditions. It was muddy at that time. It was cold. Our U.S. soldiers were not in uniform. They were walking around with their rifles, not in proper uniform, and not in proper gear. So that in itself gave me a clear indication there was some semblance of indiscipline, no proper military decorum, and they were not adhering to force protection measures. So, and the first person in our profession that you see is not the sergeant. You propel yourself a little upward, got a commanding officer. And that gave me the impression that we have a lot of work to do. And the impression was that things were not going well in that prison site.
When the question and answer period began, we did talk a little bit about Vice President Cheney. There are several questions here about former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. The first question is, how could Secretary Rumsfeld not know about the abuses at Abu Ghraib? It is said that Rumsfeld wanted to know everything that was going on.
It did. I think you read the article. I was talking to the lawyer that accompanied me at the time of my session with him, and he even elaborated. This lawyer is still on active duty, and I hasten to mention his name. Not only confirmed what I said as being factual, but he also added a couple of more things that somewhat I missed during my session with Secretary Rumsfeld. I only sat two chairs away from him. He wanted me to sit next to him. I believe General Myers was sitting to my right. And when he was looking at me and making that statement, as I mentioned on the article, that I'm only the Secretary of Defense and I have not seen this and I have not seen that. And what is not in the article is I turned to a friend of mine that was seated across the table from me, and I asked him to get that CD from the Army's military police investigators and show it to him. And I also mentioned to the Secretary that you don't have to see the photographs to make a determination that something terrible happened in that site. All it will do is confirm your suspicion of how terrible it was. And I recommended to him to not release it to the press and further fuel the animosity that's already been fueled in the region, but to take measured actions on providing copies of that CD. There were only three copies of that CD that I knew. One was with me, not with me during the time I was interviewing with him, because when I left the country, we were moving headquarters, and I directed that the CD be destroyed. Only because there were two or three other copies of that, that military investigators, criminal investigators, had a copy, and I wasn't doing a criminal investigation, I was doing an administrative investigation. So yes, I would suggest to an answer to that question that his subordinates had the capacity to produce that for him. You can't dismiss it, and you can't move on to the next agenda because email traffic was being covered, that, you know, allegations. It was just an allegations. The photographs showed it. The vision showed it. They were indescribable.
The day after the meeting you're now describing, I believe, is when Secretary Rumsfeld testified to Congress.
On the 7th of May, I believe he testified.
And so do you think he lied to Congress? And if so, maybe you already answered that question. If so, do you think...
I prefer not to answer that question.
Well, do you think, regardless of whether he lied or didn't lie, do you think that he should be prosecuted or investigated?
I prefer not to answer that question either.
Okay, I can accept that. There's another question here. I've always felt that the loyalty in the Bush administration is a misguided virtue, the way that the president defines it. So the question is, do you think that your investigation, the questioner wrote overzealous investigation, I think that was a claim, but do you think that your investigation into the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison were interpreted as disloyalty? Weren't you just doing your job to the best of your ability?
The word overzealous struck me. Somebody mentioned that while I was, I believe it was Congressman Hastings from Florida, during a closed hearing, who said that he had reports that I was being overzealous in my reporting. Well, I suggest that I didn't see those general officers who made those comments raise their hand and say, I want to do the investigation. They had the ability to do that. Why didn't they come forward? That's point number one. The loyalty bit is that prior to me and my team conducting the investigation, we all stood up and we were sworn. Like, if you were in a court of law, you were sworn to investigate, to find truth, to find evidence, and to tell the truth. And we did. All of us stood up, raised our right hand, and swore. And later on, when we completed the investigation, I didn't realize it was 6,000 pages. That was a lot. And we were only given 30 days to do that. That was the scope of the investigation. 30 days, no extension, get it done, and get it done quickly, accurately, and be sure that we brief certain commanders. But more importantly, though, the point of my answer to your question is that when we sat around the table, me and my team, is I asked them one question. Is, can our report withstand scrutiny? Can our report withstand scrutiny? And if one said no, then our rule was that we go back and comb every piece of statement, every piece of evidence whereby it will stand scrutiny, because we are going to be scrutinized. Later on, I found out I was being investigated too, but I wanted to protect them because these are junior officers that were helping with the investigation. I didn't want anyone in that team to be harmed or to be a camera put on their faces because they were doing their duty. They were doing their duty. And I will not allow them to have a camera pasted on their face because it is unfair to them. They were truthful. Most of them are still on active duty today. Most of them. I only know of one who has retired since. And there's no way I'm going to divulge them to anyone. They served honorably. They worked hard. That's why I had to pause for a moment. Because the other rule was there will be one talking head. One talking head. So, and I admire them. I really do. They're my heroes, too.
Well, General Taguba, I'm not going to ask you to name any names, certainly, of individuals. I know I would get nowhere with that, with those questions. However, the makeup of the people involved in the interrogation of the detainees was sort of a mixed bag, as I understand it. There were military police, there were military intelligence officers, there were outsourced private contractors, and then there were also third-party nationals. Can you describe that mix of interrogation and interrogators, and was the complexity of that one of the reasons that there might have been some leadership issues at Abu Ghraib prison?
You know, I had no objection about how the makeup of the detention operations were being conducted by the commanding general at the time, General Sanchez. That was his duty to do. Whether he had, but then when you conduct detainee operations, it wasn't as if we were conducting exclusively prisoners of war, enemy prisoners of war. This is a different kind of a detention operation. But we'd had regulations that were applicable to detention operations that involved civilian detainees. That it existed. It has existed since 1997, if I'm not mistaken. Because we use that as a point of reference and a series of field manuals. Now, whether they included other people to include outsourcing, which I thought was rather interesting since we did not have enough military intelligence interrogators, and we were training and we were activating reservists and the like. And if you could just imagine the growing number, you went from 5,000 to 7,000 to 8,000. Next thing you know, there were just excessive for the military police and interrogators to handle. Then you create a situation where there's a degree of stress associated with it. So it wasn't that I was investigating. It was the conduct of how they were conducting the interrogation and how they were pointing fingers at each other. It was amazing that nobody except one would account for themselves. You know. And somehow, down the line, some were making false statements to me.
Well, certainly your devotion to the United States and your patriotism is without question. But there's a question here about moral leadership or the lack thereof. Do you think, sir, that the United States has lost its moral ascendancy to lead in the rebuilding efforts in Iraq? And if so, what should be done?
Let me answer it this way. In our military, especially in the Army, I can't speak for the Marines or the Air Force or the Navy, but I know they will also subscribe to this, that our country, our Army, our soldiers, our Marine, our Navy, deserves the best leadership that the Army, the Navy can provide. There's no greater honor, when the mothers and fathers of America entrust their sons and daughters to you as a leader to ensure that they're properly led, they're properly trained, they're properly equipped, and also fed and paid. And that extends to their families. We say that is not a bumper sticker. That is part of our core value. And one would think that our country deserves the same or the best above all of that leadership that our country can provide. And I believe in that. But sometimes the leadership is not there. And that's where we're at today. You know, the polls notwithstanding, but I believe that our ability to uphold the prestige that this country has had for a number of centuries has now been questioned. If you travel in Europe, a lot of negative press there. As I traveled in the Middle East and Southwest Asia at that time, my friends from the other countries would say, we like you, General Taguba. We like your country. We are just opposed to your foreign policy. And what is wrong with your commander? Now, I don't answer that. I said, well, I'm apolitical. I'm here to extend friendship, to collaborate on our training processes, to help you defend your country. But those things, those comments resonate with me today. So I leave it to that.
Well, General Antonio Taguba, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question.
Okay. This is the culminating point?
This is a good question, because it's one that you'll, I'm sure, will answer from the heart. Several questions actually asked were very similar, and that is basically, when did you realize that your career, professional career, was at an end? And let me just tag on a final question, and that is, would you recommend a professional military career to the sons and daughters of close friends or to your own family?
I'll answer the last question first. Absolutely. We are a nation where we subscribe to service to nation. It doesn't necessarily be in the military, but we pride ourselves that we give back to the country, we give back to the community. And you can serve in the Peace Corps, you can serve in a humanitarian service, or you could go and help out in your community. That's serving your nation. There's another aspect of that called call to duty. Call to duty, which is the sublimest word in our English language today, so says this great hero of mine named Robert E. Lee. Sublimest word in our nation today. Duty, call to duty. You serve your nation in uniform. And great, but not, it's not for everybody. So I applaud the fact that we do have our young men and women serving in uniform today. The other aspect is, when did my career end? When you get subpoenaed to before Congress, as I was, on 9 May 2004, on Mother's Day, I remember that very vividly, when my commanding officer on my way back to Kuwait, because I turned off my cell phone, I didn't want to be bothered, and I made the mistake of turning it back on. And he said, you're being subpoenaed to appear before Congress. We get prepared. General Myatt and all general officers are prepared to appear before Congress, and that preparation includes study, that includes rehearsing your remarks, that includes preparing your opening remarks, that includes conduct before members of Congress, and the like. But that day on the 10th of May, I just sat there, not knowing what kind of questions I was going to be asked or what the format was going to be. All I was told was it will be a Senate Armed Services Committee appearance. All 25 members will be there. It will be an open hearing. Open hearing to Taguba is C-SPAN. Okay. Taguba did not know it was going to be all sorts of cameras out there. I thought, and I believe, that if I did not tell the truth before Congress, it was going to be a losing proposition, because I thought about my character and I thought about my integrity. If I told the truth before Congress, I won't have to worry about my character and I won't have to worry about my integrity, especially when the camera is zooming in on you all the time. So at that point in time, I felt threatened, but, you know, it's about maintaining your faith, maintaining your faith in your friends, and maintaining your faith in your family, because otherwise, you lose all that sense of reality. And then I had a lot of people tell me that I'm a dead ender. Okay. I was rather disturbed that I was being reassigned back to the Pentagon after three tours and to be placed in the staff of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. A senator called me a couple of days after that assignment was announced and asked me if that was retaliation on my candor and openness during the testimony, and I said, no, sir. This is a lateral assignment, and general officers and flag officers do not quibble about their assignment. We will ensure, or I will ensure, that I will give it my 110%. It was a duty to be assigned. But later on, you start to connect the dots when somebody says, I need you to retire, as opposed to, have you thought about retiring? Those are two different statements. So at that point in time, and then another boss said, I no longer need you in my team, and not offer a reason why, other than the first year that I served with that leader, senior official, gave me high praises on my efficiency report. And then 6 months later, he said, thank you very much for your service, and not look me in the eye and tell me. So I connected that dot. But I'm pleased, and I think that my service to nation is a wonderful experience for me. If I had to do it again, I'd do it. I probably would not change a bit, except maybe when I was a young lieutenant and careless and carefree. But it's a wonderful service. So I served and wished to serve. And I mentioned to Jeremiah, my good friend, that nobody ever wants to leave a service while our nation is at war and our troops are at harm's way. It's a certain bond for those of you who've served. You just don't want to let go because young men and women are dying or doing the fighting for our country.
Well, General Taguba, you are a dedicated citizen of the Army, to the United States, and certainly to yourself. Thank you very much. So our thanks to retired U.S. Army General Antonio Taguba for speaking with us tonight.
Please
sit
down.
Thank our audience here and on
Please
the radio. Thanks to all of you here and on the radio. Today's program has been co-organized by the Marines Memorial Association. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.